coming to you from the Motor City.
Hello, and welcome to Detroit's Daily Docket. On this episode, we will be discussing homicidal asphyxiation. The doctors will describe different types of asphyxia, from manual strangulation to smothering. Later, take a journey through the lens of forensic photography with Dr. Sung.
I'd like to thank everyone for coming back. I'm Dr. Lachman Sung, and our Deputy Chief Medical Examiner, Dr. Labby, is here with me today. This episode looks at asphyxia, but specifically in regard to homicides. Quite simply, we'll examine the ways that people kill each other by preventing them from breathing. It can be a very challenging and confusing topic because there is a lot of overlap between the categories or types of asphyxia, and the terms can be mixed up between what the forensic community uses and what the public uses. Also, the overall findings can be very subtle. The areas that we'll be covering are going to be manual strangulation, ligature strangulation, and smothering. Let's first start with manual strangulation.
Manual strangulation is pressure placed on the neck by another's hands, but it can also be another body part such as the forearm or leg. And that pressure cuts off the blood supply to the brain and results in death. The blood vessels on either side of your neck are being blocked from bringing blood to and from your brain. It's not choking per se, as the airway itself is not being blocked. And there isn't just one finding that indicates manual strangulation. It's a constellation or group of findings. And each of these findings by themselves can be caused by multiple things besides strangulation. But when present together, it means the person was strangled.
You mentioned a constellation of findings. What is it that you look for that initiates the suspicion or points you in the direction of a strangulation?
There are four findings in this group. The first is congestion of the face. Pressure on the neck that cuts off the blood from draining from the head results in the face getting very red, purple, or blue in color. The second is petechia on the face, eyelid, eyes, and tissue lining the eye sockets. As the pressure inside the head increases, it ruptures the tiniest blood vessels, which are called capillaries, in these areas, resulting in tiny pinpoint hemorrhages that are called petechia. The third finding is fingertip and fingernail bruises and abrasions on the neck and on the undersurface of the jaw. Fingertips can leave round or oval bruises on the neck. Fingernails can leave small linear or slightly curved scratches on the neck. These marks can be made by the assailant doing the strangling or by the victim trying to get their hands off of their neck. The fourth finding are the internal neck injuries, which consist of bleeding in the neck muscles and fractures of the throat, specifically the hyoid bone and thyroid cartilage. Pathologists perform a special neck dissection after the head and chest and abdominal organs have been removed in order to find these hemorrhages and fractures. Now, a common myth is that neck fractures and strangulation indicate the amount of force the assailant used. These fractures are more a function of how old the victim was and are more likely the older you are. They're not a function of how much pressure was placed on the neck or the size and strength of the assailant.
To give a little context, for those of you that are not familiar with our office, we often have medical students that come through as an elective rotation during their medical school training. Compared to the other types of homicide, we don't frequently have manual strangulation, but when we do, the students sometimes ask me, how long does it take to strangle someone? And I don't always have a great answer for that. Dr. Labby, what's your opinion?
Strangulation is not a quick or a sudden act. It takes minutes of constant pressure on the neck to bring about death.
That's definitely not what you see on TV and in the movies. Why does it take minutes?
That is how long your brain cells can survive without oxygen before they die, and you with them. Strangulation is a multi-step process. First, there is a period of struggle, and constant pressure cannot be maintained on the neck until the victim is overcome. Now, the length of this step is variable, and it depends on the strength of the assailant and the victim's health, any drugs or alcohol in the victim, and any coexisting trauma. Once constant pressure can be kept on the neck, it has to remain there for at least 2 to 2.5 minutes more in order for death to occur. The victim will lose consciousness in about 30 seconds, and then that pressure has to remain around the neck of the unconscious victim for the remainder of the time in order to bring about death.
Now, that's not the same for everyone, is it?
No, it can take less time to strangle certain individuals. Think of your brain cells as having an oxygen meter, and any insult to your system, whether it be significant underlying diseases, drugs or alcohol on board, or other injuries to the body, can deplete your brain cells of oxygen and lower that meter. It would then take less time to completely deplete those brain cells of oxygen through strangulation and result in death.
So what you're saying is that these underlying conditions, or what we call comorbidities, can shorten the time it takes to strangle someone to death. For example, if you had two people, person A and person B, who were exactly the same, let's say they were clones of each other, but the only difference was that person A had the comorbid condition of a previous heart attack, it would take less time to strangle to death person A than it would person B. Changing things a little bit, what about choking? Although they're different, strangulation and choking are terms that are frequently used interchangeably in the general public. For example, during sex, it's frequently referred to as choking. Is that really accurate to do?
Well, choking is actually blockage of the airway itself, usually by an object like a piece of food. Strangulation is pressure placed on the outside of the neck that blocks the blood flow to the brain. But regardless of the term used, these deaths are not choking someone during sex because they like it rough and it simply went too far and somehow ended up killing them. Choking during rough sex would be until the victim loses consciousness, and then once the pressure was removed from the neck, the victim would wake back up. Pressure that remains on the neck for minutes and on the neck of an unconscious person is strangulation. Now, choking during rough sex that somehow ended up causing death is a frequent story heard from defendants in strangulation cases. Something along the lines of, sure, the victim was choked, consensually, of course, but it stopped when they passed out, and I have no idea how they died. So how do we know that the pressure on the neck went on longer than what was admitted to, other than it resulted in a dead person? Well, we can look to the research done by the emergency medicine doctors on people who have survived being nearly strangled. In these patients, survivors will have congested faces with petechial hemorrhages and marks on the outside of their neck. The patients who are comatose, have brain damage, or end up dying are those with the internal neck injuries, the muscle hemorrhages, and the fractures. So it's those internal injuries that help tell us that the choking was taken too far.
To cement these concepts, I'm going to give you an example of a victim of manual strangulation, and that's the death of Shannon Watts. Before I go further, I have heard several different ways to pronounce her first name. I don't know which way is necessarily correct, but I'm going to pronounce it Shannon. So I apologize in advance if that's not the right way. But Shannon Watts was 34 years old, and she was married to Christopher Watts. They had two daughters, Bella, who was 4, and Celeste, who was 3 years old. They lived in Frederick, Colorado, and the husband, Chris, was in the petroleum business, and Shannon worked for a marketing company. In the very early hours of August 13, 2018, Shannon returned home from a business trip, and later that morning, she had a scheduled obstetrics appointment because she was 15 weeks pregnant. However, she never made that appointment, and she also missed another business meeting. So the police were called to her home to make a welfare check in the early afternoon on that same day. The husband, Christopher, came home from work, spoke with the police, and gave them permission to search the house. I don't have the details of the police investigation, but in the end, the husband was arrested 2 days later on August 15th. During his interrogation, he confessed to strangling his wife and also killing their two daughters. He used his company vehicle to transport the bodies to his work site, where he dumped the bodies of the girls in separate oil tankers and buried Shannon in a nearby shallow grave. The police found the bodies on August 16th. Shannon was face down in a grave in a fetal position. Her body was decomposing with generalized discoloration of the skin, bloating of the soft tissue, and skin slippage. Something to note is that while the husband eventually confessed to the murders and gave the timeline beginning and occurring on August 13, the official date of death is listed as August 16, 2018. It may sound strange, but it's actually pretty common. And that's because unwitnessed accounts cannot necessarily be corroborated. But what is certain is the day that Shannon and the daughters were found dead. And that's what is entered as the official date of death.
In future episodes, we will cover postmortem changes and estimating time of death. But here we will say that the description of the postmortem changes fits the reported timeline of death, subsequent burial, and discovery of the body 3 days later.
What was difficult in this case was that there was no congestion of the face and no petechiae were described on the eyes, particularly the sclera and conjunctiva, or on the eyelids or skin of the face. These findings would be expected in strangulation cases, but the changes associated with the decomposition of the body and her being face down can mask these findings. However, on the skin of the neck, there were these linear, purple-black circular abrasions of various sizes that extended from below the chin, along the jawline, and towards the left temple. These circular abrasions most likely represent marks made by the fingertips of the assailant, and in this case, the husband. Moving on to the internal examination, the strap muscles of the neck had bruising, with the right side being more severe than the left. Bruising was also found overlying the right side of both the hyoid bone and the thyroid cartilage. The bone and the cartilage were not fractured, but that's what would be expected in a person of Shannon's age. The rest of the autopsy showed no other injuries and no natural diseases. The fetus that was present was too decomposed to determine the gender. Also, with the decomposition of Shannon's body, they couldn't submit the standard blood for toxicology, so samples from the spleen were sent instead. From those samples, toxicology did reveal some alcohol. Now, that doesn't mean that Shannon was drinking while she was pregnant. It was there because a small amount of alcohol can be produced in the body during the decomposition.
So what is your conclusion in this case?
Even without the confession, and despite the body being decomposed and buried in a shallow grave, these autopsy findings indicate that the cause of death is manual strangulation, and the manner is homicide.
Now let's move on to smothering. Smothering is blockage of the nose and mouth that prevents oxygen from reaching the lungs and resulting in death. Hands can be used to block the nose and mouth, or objects like a pillow or plastic bag can be used. Smothering can have no findings, especially if the victim is an infant or easily overcome, or if an object like a pillow was used to smother. Smothering can have fingernail marks on the nose if it was pinched, and fingernail marks may be around the mouth if a hand was used to block it. There may be injuries on the inside of the mouth as well, as the lips are forced down upon the teeth. The frenulum, which is the thin piece of tissue that connects your lips to your gum line at the midline of your upper and lower jaw, may also be torn. If the victim struggles, they may leave fingernail marks on their own face. There are no internal findings in smothering, specifically no muscle hemorrhages or fractures, as the neck is not being squeezed. It's the nose and mouth that are being blocked.
A very common question is, how long does it take to smother someone?
It actually takes less time than strangulation. Doctors DeMaio and DeMaio, in their text entitled Forensic Pathology, outlined the sequence of events in the smothering of infants. First, there is a decrease in heart rate, then a decrease in breathing, and then finally flattening of the brain waves. In infants, the decrease in heart rate occurs after about 30 seconds, and the brain waves flatten after about 90 seconds. If the smothering stops once the decrease in breathing happens, the infant will not spontaneously wake up and must be resuscitated.
If we go back to the Watts family, the mother, Shannon, died of manual strangulation. The daughters, on the other hand, were not strangled. Both Bella and Celeste Watts were smothered. As I briefly mentioned earlier, the body of Bella Watts, the 4-year-old daughter, was found in an oil tanker at Christopher Watts' work site. Her body was submerged in oil, and her body showed more decomposition than her mother's did. Also, the fluids that were needed to wash away the oils caused abundant slippage of the skin. Oil, water, and sludge debris were found in her stomach, and her blood tested positive for the hydrocarbon chemicals present in the oil tanker.
These do not indicate that she was alive when placed in the tanker, but more likely represent the decomposition process and an artifact of being submerged in the tanker contents for days.
Right. Regarding the other autopsy findings, when the rest of her body was examined, there was tearing and bruising of her upper frenulum. As Dr. Lavdy mentioned earlier, the frenulum is that loose tissue that connects your gum line to your lips. The injury to the frenulum indicates that Bella's nose and lips were forcibly pressed down onto her mouth, and covering them prevented her from breathing. There were also probable bite marks on her tongue. The rest of the autopsy showed no other injuries occurred prior to or at the time of her death, but what were present were a few post-mortem injuries, or injuries that occurred after death. These were abrasions or scrapes that were made from dragging the body and moving the body after the girl was killed. You can tell that these were made after death because these abrasions or scrapes showed no vital reaction.
What is a vital reaction?
Yes, vital reaction. These are the changes that you see when a living body has been injured. In a living body with a beating heart and moving circulation, an injury will bleed and look red and moist. A dead body has no beating heart, so abrasions that occur after death, such as in the dragging of Bella Watts' body, those abrasions will not have that vital reaction and will appear dried out. They'll be stiff and yellow.
So what is your conclusion in this case?
Just as with the mother, even without the confession, these autopsy findings indicate that the cause of death is smothering and the manner is also homicide. Now, the findings of the body of the 3-year-old Celeste was a little different. Her body was found at the bottom of a different oil tanker than her sister. Externally, her body was in the same condition as Bella's and had the majority of her skin sloughed off during the washing process prior to autopsy. Her body was exposed to the hydrocarbons in the oil tanker, and her spleen tissue was also tested and was positive for those hydrocarbons. What was different was that her body had no injuries whatsoever. There was no tearing of the frenulum like Bella had.
Again, these do not indicate that she was alive and placed in the tanker, but more likely represent the decomposition process and an artifact of being submerged in the tanker contents for days. So can you draw the same conclusions about both girls' deaths?
As for the manner of death, the circumstances surrounding Celeste's death and the disposition of the body indicate that her death was a homicide. Now, in cases without a confession or companion cases, homicide by unspecified means or similar phrasing is used to indicate that the death is a homicide, but the lack of the autopsy findings prevents a determination of the exact cause. In such cases, all other causes except smothering are ruled out, but there is simply no other findings and information regarding the circumstances that precludes the medical examiner from quote-unquote pulling the trigger on a cause. In the case of Celeste, however, there were companion homicides and a confession, so the diagnosis of smothering can be made. Going back to the different forms of asphyxia, we've covered smothering and manual strangulation, where essentially the hands of the assailant were used. Can you give us some information about ligature strangulation?
Ligature strangulation is pressure placed around the neck by an object that is tightened by the assailant's force. Any number of objects can be used as a ligature, such as rope, belt, or wire, and the ligature typically leaves a corresponding mark around the neck. If a soft ligature, such as a cloth bathrobe belt, is used, there may not be any mark on the neck. The ligature mark, if present, is usually horizontal or straight across the neck. Similar to manual strangulation, ligature strangulation results in blockage of the blood flow to and from the brain with the same constellation of findings. Fingertip and fingernail marks may be on the neck if the victim tries to pry the ligature off their neck. The head above the ligature mark will be congested, and petechia will be present on the face, eyelids, eyes, and tissue lining the eye sockets. Internal neck muscle hemorrhages and fractures in the throat may be present. Now let's examine a case of ligature strangulation, JonBenet Ramsey. Even though this is one of the most fascinating unsolved murders in U.S. history, we are sticking to our format and only discussing the autopsy findings. We will not comment on the scene, circumstances, or investigation. We do not have the autopsy photos or slides and are basing our conclusions solely off of the autopsy report. And we are not going to comment on the genitalia findings.
JonBenet Ramsey was a child beauty contestant. She came from an affluent family in Colorado, and sadly, she was only 6 years old at the time of her death. She was found dead in the basement of her home on Christmas Day in 1996 after being reported missing for about 8 hours earlier in the day. Her body was moved from the basement to the living room, and when the medical examiner went to the scene, she was lying on her back with her arms extended over her head. There were ligatures wrapped around her neck and right wrist. The ligature that was around the right wrist was a thin white cord, and it was tied loosely over the sleeve of the shirt that she was wearing. The ligature around her neck was similar to the one around her wrist. It was also a white cord, and it was double knotted at the mid-back of the neck. The longer end or tail of the cord was looped several times around a 4.5-inch wooden stick. Underlying this ligature was a deep indented furrow that was circumferential around the neck and nearly horizontal. Additionally, there were associated abrasions and petechial hemorrhages of the skin of the neck, abrasions below the right ear and at the angle of the jaw, and also on the right side of the chin. These are all common locations for injuries in a strangulation case, either from the assailant or the victim trying to pry the ligature off their neck. Petechiae were present on her conjunctiva, eyelids, and skin of the face. During the autopsy, the internal dissection of the neck revealed no internal strap muscle hemorrhages and no fractures of the thyroid cartilage or of the hyoid bone.
JonBenet had all of the external indicators of ligature strangulation, but she had no internal injuries. Does this mean that she wasn't strangled to death?
In keeping with what we know from survivors of near strangulations and chokings, if this was the only trauma to her body, the lack of internal injuries may have indicated that she would have survived the attack. I want to emphasize may. In JonBenet Ramsey's case, the ligature injuries were not the only trauma present, and the victim has to be considered in totality when determining the cause of death.
Any coexisting injury can contribute to both the cause of death and the length of time it takes to die in strangulation cases. It can contribute to the cause of death, meaning just because you are being strangled does not mean that you cannot be beaten. If the coexisting injury by itself was severe enough to result in death independent of being strangled, for instance, being beaten in the head with multiple impact sites, skull fractures, and bleeding on the brain, then it qualifies as a cause of death along with strangulation. Whether or not the coexisting trauma was severe enough to have resulted in death independent of the strangulation, all injuries present can shorten the length of time it takes to die from strangulation. Again, think of your brain cells as having an oxygen meter, and any injuries present can lower that meter. Now back to JonBenet Ramsey.
As I mentioned before, the injuries from the ligature were not the only injuries. She was also beaten. Other than what I've described about the strangulation, there were no other external injuries on her body or her head. But upon reflection of the scalp, there was an extensive area of hemorrhage or bleeding underneath the right side of the scalp.
How can you be beaten with no external injuries present on your head?
Actually, that's not unusual. If anything, it's common not to find any abrasions or bruises or lacerations on the top, sides, and the back of the head because those parts are covered with hair. The hair acts as a buffer between the blunt object and the skin surface. Evidence of the impact was underneath the scalp, though. There was a complex skull fracture that extended from the area of hemorrhage through the right half of her skull. And in the area directly underlying the scalp hemorrhage, there was a rectangular depressed skull fracture, indicating that a rectangular object struck her head with significant force. There was bleeding onto the right half of the brain, both subdural and subarachnoid hemorrhages, and extensive bruising on the right side of the brain underlying the fracture. These are significant injuries that indicate that she died from blunt force trauma to the head. Her brain did show some evidence of mild swelling, meaning Along with the extensive injuries, there was a short survival time, and she died shortly after this beating.
But what about the ligature strangulation?
The findings in and of themselves may not necessarily predict death, but in the context of someone beaten in this fashion, it would take significantly less time to strangle before resulting in death. So much less that the internal injuries did not have time to fully develop. To round out this discussion, let's move on to chokeholds and asphyxia during police arrests.
Chokeholds and deaths during restraint is a current topic of national importance, and it is a topic that we will revisit again. Here we will focus on neck holds and compression of the chest and abdomen during restraint.
As with so many things, the word choke hold might mean one thing to one person and something different to another. So that we can have a uniform discussion, what is a choke hold?
A choke hold is where an arm or object is placed flat against the front of the neck and the free hand pulls the arm or object back and compresses the actual airway or larynx. So while the airway is being blocked, the blood vessels on either side of the neck are uninvolved. There may be fingernail marks on the neck from the victim struggling. Now, once the victim passes out, the neck should be released. But if a chokehold is carried too far, the throat is crushed and it results in internal neck hemorrhages and fractures.
How is that different than a carotid sleeper hold?
A carotid artery sleeper hold is where the neck is placed in the crook of an arm and the free hand pulls the arm back, compressing the neck blood vessels and the carotid bodies. The carotid body is a group of cells on both sides of the neck that monitor oxygen levels in the blood and send signals to the respiratory and cardiovascular systems to regulate the oxygen levels. So with the carotid artery sleeper hold, the blood vessels are being blocked while the airway is uninvolved. And if held until loss of consciousness, which is about 30 seconds, there are usually no findings present except possible fingernail marks if the victim struggled. Now, if held until death, then this is actually manual strangulation and the constellation of findings is expected.
This is different than people who are so-called hog-tied with their hands and or feet tied together behind their backs and then being placed down on their abdomen.
Sitting or kneeling on the back of someone who is lying on the ground on their stomach prevents their chest wall and diaphragm from being able to move and breathe. Their actual airway and neck blood vessels are not being blocked. Because there's usually a lot of activity and commotion surrounding these encounters, by the time it is noticed that the victim is unresponsive, death has usually already occurred. The findings to indicate asphyxia from compression of the chest and abdomen can include congestion of the body above the point of compression, petechia on the face and eyes, and occasionally hemorrhage in the chest wall itself. Now let's examine a case of death during arrest with use of a chokehold, namely that of Mr. Eric Garner.
Eric Garner was a 43-year-old man who died during an arrest by New York City police officers in 2014. I want to preface that his autopsy report has not been made public record in its entirety. However, the relevant parts of the autopsy have been referenced in several public official documents. And although our format is that we only discuss cases where the autopsy report is public record, Mr. Gardner's death is such a classic example of asphyxia during arrest and chokeholds that we decided to include it in our discussion. It was reported that two officers attempted to arrest Eric Garner for selling untaxed cigarettes, and he tried to talk his way out of the arrest. It was interpreted as resisting arrest, and one officer placed his right arm under Mr. Garner's right armpit and his left arm over Mr. Garner's left shoulder and brought Eric Garner to the ground in a prone position. Prone means lying flat with the chest and abdomen facing downward. Although New York City police were expressly instructed not to use chokeholds, and the officer claimed to have not used such a maneuver, eyewitness cell phone videos captured photos of the officer with his left arm in front of Eric Garner's neck and his right hand pulling on his left while on the ground and on top of Mr. Garner. While on the ground, Garner was heard to be saying that he was wheezing and that he couldn't breathe before he became silent. He was moved onto his side while EMS was called, and at most 10 minutes passed between the time the officer grabs Mr. Garner and EMS arrives. He was transported to the hospital, where he was pronounced dead.
What did the autopsy find?
The autopsy revealed no external neck injuries, but as we said before, it's common with chokeholds performed with an arm. There were, however, petechial hemorrhages on the conjunctiva and face. Internally, the neck revealed hemorrhages in the bilateral neck strap muscles, or muscles of both sides of the neck. No neck or throat fractures were present. These findings were consistent with an inability to breathe due to, and I quote, compression of the neck, chokehold, chest compression, prone positioning during physical restraint by police, end quote, as a cause of death ruled by the medical examiner. While the autopsy findings and videos clearly indicate the use of a chokehold, you can't ignore the added component of positional asphyxia. Here, he was placed prone and weight was added onto his back, compromising the ability of his chest wall to move and to breathe.
Did the autopsy find anything else of note?
Mr. Gardner was morbidly obese. He was 6'2" and weighed 395 pounds. That gives him a calculated body mass index of over 50 kilograms per meter squared. Now, this is not going to be a discussion of body mass index, but for those of you that are not familiar with this calculation, it's a screening tool that helps gauge the amount of fat or health of an individual. In general, people with a BMI of over 40 are considered morbidly obese, meaning that your weight alone increases your risk for other diseases and health conditions, such as strain on the heart and diabetes, just to name two. This number is not absolute because there are some very fit people and healthy people that have very high BMIs. But in proper context, Mr. Gardner was morbidly obese. Other findings on Eric Gardner's autopsy were that he had enlargement of the heart to twice its normal size due to high blood pressure and evidence of asthma in his lungs. Acute and chronic asthma, obesity, and hypertensive heart disease were all listed as contributory causes of death, as they all can shorten the amount of time it takes to asphyxiate. Once again, using that meter analogy, think of your brain cells as having only so much oxygen reserve in them before their meter runs out and they die. All three of these health conditions lower this meter, and thus Mr. Gardner would asphyxiate quicker in this circumstance than someone without these conditions. What I hope you can appreciate is that there are many physical and physiologic factors that can influence an asphyxial death. Sometimes the findings are exactly what you'd see page per page in a textbook, but other times there may be no findings at all. Because of that, it can be a cause of death that can be very difficult to prove or, on the other hand, exclude. Clearly, anyone who thinks about forensic pathology can imagine that there are a number of injuries that we see, and those injuries have to be documented. Sometimes the best way to do so is through photographs. But taking a good picture for a forensic purpose is not as simple as walking up to a body, pointing a camera at it, and taking a shot. Now, I'm not saying that a medical examiner's office can't use a point-and-shoot camera. That's not it at all. It's not the equipment that I'm talking about. It's the person behind the lens. The photographer necessarily must have several layers of understanding. Of course, they'll receive direction from the medical examiner, but there needs to be that eye for detail and that knowledge of injury patterns. For example, recognizing that bruising on the body may not just be a bruise, but that of a tread pattern from a boot that was used to stomp on a victim, or that an abrasion around a gunshot wound is actually the imprint of the muzzle of the gun that was used in a suicide. Having that knowledge is key. But the photographer's job goes beyond that. They have to accurately capture and demonstrate that injury. So there may be obscuring blood, leaking fluids, insects like bed bugs, lice, and maggots, and sometimes algae and fish from people recovered from the water, and mice inside clothing. And all of that has to be contended with before you can even take a picture. So establishing context and composing the shot is very important. When it comes to the subtle findings of asphyxia on the body, some of the injuries that can be seen with the naked eye are quite hard to document and capture photographically. I'm going to now introduce you to our photographers, and we'll discuss their backgrounds and some of the challenges they have when it comes to forensic photography.
I'm Sierra. I'm a forensic photographer.
I'm Kelly Root, and I'm a forensic photographer at the Wayne County Medical Examiner.
Welcome. Now, before we get too much into what you do, can you at least walk us through how it is that you came to our office?
I think I'll start with this one.
All right, Kelly, go ahead.
I was attending the College for Creative Studies as a photography major. I was working on my thesis project, and I contacted the ME's office. I ended up doing an internship, and then I was hired after that. So I have a Bachelor of Fine Arts degree. I also took biomedical photography courses as well, and I just really had a general interest in artifacts of death and the job that the forensic pathologists do here.
Mm-hmm. A repeating theme is a lot of people don't know that we have photographers in the office. They don't know that we have clerical investigators. So sometimes it's hard for people just to even know what it is that you're doing. So you came through that way. How about you, Sierra?
I actually have a really similar story because I also went to the College for Creative Studies and was getting my photography degree and had always been interested in forensics and sort of biomedical art, I guess. So I thought about doing medical illustration, and a lot of teachers told me that people had done internships here at the ME's office, and so I basically reached out to the office and to Kelly and did an internship and then got hired part-time and then just recently got hired full-time.
Do you think that's a way that a lot of photographers have at least been introduced to this field?
In the past 20 years, yes.
Yeah, I was going to say more recently, because when she was going to CCS, they had, like she said, the biomedical photography classes, but they didn't have that when I was there. So I just kind of had to reach out myself and learn everything on the job.
Now, Kelly, you've been here quite a while. I'm sure you've seen everything. Sierra, because your time with us has been shorter, is there anything that has surprised you when you came on staff?
I mean, I would say, honestly, that I was more surprised in myself that I could handle it. Because when I came in to start my internship, you know, I didn't really know what to expect. If you've only seen dead bodies during a funeral, it's very different than if you're coming to the medical examiner's office. So being able to just handle it was very surprising.
And it's kind of a personal challenge sometimes.
Yeah,
for
sure. Definitely.
Now, Kelly, can you walk us through some of the main responsibilities that a forensic photographer has?
At the medical examiner's office, our main responsibilities are to photograph and document artifacts of death and fatal injury, to accompany autopsy reports for use in courtroom trials, to help identify unknown human remains, and also for educational and public relations purposes.
I think there's probably a subset of people that are listening thinking, or you're just taking pictures of dead bodies. How hard can that be?
I'm
sure that's very, very different from the truth. What are some of the challenges that you have in actually taking pictures of dead bodies and injuries?
So like most photographers understand, I think, is that you are in some ways responsible for what your subject looks like. So as I like to say it, we have to style the cases. We are shooting to name standards. So we need to make sure that the area that we're photographing is clean, it's free of debris, you can clearly see the injury, and
it's a lot more physical,
right,
than I probably even thought it was going to be. I feel like I'm putting my body in weird positions too, standing on stools a lot, sort of hunching over or bending over, trying to get into the right spots you can see. Because the person can't move themselves, so sometimes you're in sort of an awkward position trying to get the shot if it's in a weird spot on their body, like behind someone's ear. Mm-hmm. If someone was shot behind the ear, that's a tough spot to photograph, but mm-hmm. We have our ways. So a lot of setting things up, propping things up, using a lot of tools.
Standing on one foot, holding a hemostat in one hand and your camera in the other.
It's a very physical job.
Yeah, but it is a hard job. Like we were saying, it's physical, it can take up a good majority of the day. If it's a busy day, we'll be in there, you know, for 4 or 5 hours on our feet with everyone else.
Now, you mentioned briefly a little bit about biomedical photography. Tell us a little bit about that and how you think it's going to change.
So when I first was introduced to biomedical photography, we were still shooting film. So we were shooting black and white film, color slide film. Since digital photography has taken over, a lot of those positions that biomedical photographers held have now become automated. So for instance, photographs taken during surgery, they have an automated camera that is on an arm, similar to the light that you see in a dentist's office, so mm-hmm. that the doctors can just take the photos. It's completely automated.
I really think that there'd be a challenge here in the forensic environment, because an injury can be anywhere on the body. It can be in the axilla or the armpit. It might be easy to think you can just put a body on a transparent table and then take a picture of the entire body. But that's just really scratching the surface, because you really have to physically be there to move an arm, move a leg, clean off the blood. Those are things that are not easily automated.
I would say that the photographers at this office have a very specialized skill set, yes. And a lot of that does involve manipulating the body, moving the body, stretching out rigor, things of that nature, mm-hmm. shaving, cleaning.
Yeah, it's a total body experience.
Yeah.
So focusing on this episode's topic of homicidal strangulations, homicidal asphyxia, Dr. Laverty and I covered manual strangulation, ligature strangulation. When you approach that case, what are some of the specific things that you're looking for, and how do you go about photographing them?
I think first and foremost, we want to take a good look at the body when it comes in as is, before the clothing is removed, before any ligatures are removed. We're looking for signs of a struggle. We're looking for contusions, abrasions. Specifically with manual strangulation, we're looking for abrasions around the ears, around the neck. So fingernail abrasions from manual strangulation.
We'll also usually look at the person's eyes to see if there's any petechial hemorrhage. And something that's helpful too is we get to look at the scene photos that the investigators take. We usually get to look at them every morning, so that also helps determine sort of what photographs we'll be taking that day and how we can approach.
Kind of gives us a head start.
Yeah.
What to look for.
In addition to making the injuries look good, you sometimes make us look good. If you go on our Instagram page, you'll see some of the photos that Kelly has taken. And I jokingly mentioned that, but part of our office is public relations.
Yes. So this is a great opportunity to really create more fine art images, still lives. But there are so many interesting people that work here. And it's really, our post room is really quite beautiful. It's lit by skylights. So there's a really great quality of light there as well.
What would you say some of the highlights of this position are?
It's just a really interesting job. And I know when I first started, it seemed like a very important job. I felt like I was giving back to society in some way. You know, it's important documenting homicides and making sure that people are held accountable for their actions. But yeah, it's just it's really interesting job. And I think if you're interested in how people live and die, you see a lot of that here. Things that you don't see on the news, as they say, truth is stranger than fiction.
I feel like I'm learning something new every day, which is really exciting. And every day is different. It's kind of like what Kelly said. I feel like I'm giving back to the communities. And I think most people are interested. Everyone watches CSI shows, so it's that morbid fascination.
You bring up CSI, Sierra. Now, clearly that's television.
Yes.
But what do you think one of the biggest misconceptions about Friends of Photography is?
It's so busy in the post room. It's got a big caseload, and
there's more than one person doing all of that work.
So it's a very efficient place. It's not the sort of glamorous, slow, easygoing place in a TV show. And other things do take time. You know, we can't get instant results for toxicology or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Nobody is wearing high heels out to a crime scene.
No.
Well, you might not be, but I definitely do.
I'm learning something new about you, Dr. Sung.
Well, thank you very much for coming on with me today.
Thank you, Dr. Sung.
So that wraps up episode 4 on homicidal asphyxia. It can be a cause of death that is particularly challenging. The findings during autopsy can be very subtle, and you have to really integrate all of the scene investigation, all of the police reports, and all of those other findings to get a better picture of what's going on. Thankfully, it's not a cause that we encounter very frequently. Now, please join us for episode 5, where we will expand on asphyxia, where we will cover various types of hangings and also delve into autoerotic asphyxia. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for joining us on Detroit's Daily Docket. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts. Rate and review this podcast and share it with your friends. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Detroit's Daily Docket. Our theme song is Living by Read the Sun, and our podcast cover art is by Hollow Wicked Prince. Thank you for listening.